Are you tired of the same boring and unhealthy diet of corporate media propaganda and the distraction du jour? Your antidote is here at Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. Real, revolutionary, and relevant news and talk with fascinating and brilliant guests. Prepare to be informed and motivated with your friend and host, Cindy Sheehan.
Welcome back to the Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. This week, we have a very special guest, the General Secretary of the Revolutionary Organization of Labor, USA, which is ROL USA, Ray Light. Ray and I will be chatting about especially the Empire's newest attack on Syria and many other subjects. So stay tuned and we'll be right back with Ray Light. Ray Light, General Secretary of Revolutionary Organization of Labor, USA, welcome back to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox.
It's always good to be with you, my dear sister.
Well, I'm glad that we could finally make this work with our schedules and everything to get back together and have you back on the show. So before, when we made this appointment to have the interview, it was before the U.S., the Imperial Forces of the United States, bombed an airfield in Homs, Syria.
Idlib.
Well, it was the airfield was in Homs. The so-called sarin gas incident was in Idlib.
You're right. Okay.
So anyway, we didn't know that happened, and well, it hadn't happened yet.
Right, exactly.
And so, of course, being anti-imperialist organization, and Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox is adamantly anti-imperialist. I'd like to analyze this event. It's not Trump didn't just invent bombing Syria. The U.S. has been arming terrorist forces there for the express purpose of regime change for years during the Obama administration. And it's not the first time Trump has bombed someplace either. He bombed for sure Mosul, Iraq, and has increased with Saudi Arabia the bombing of the poor country of Yemen. But what we found to be extraordinarily not coincidental about this whole event is hours before Trump actually ordered the bombing, which, you know, it's not Trump. Trump is just the manager of the U.S. empire. It's a policy of the empire. Clinton, Hillary Clinton, his supposed opponent in the 2016 presidential elections, actually seem to have ordered him to do it. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, as you are well aware, the Revolutionary Organization of Labor, USA, which we'll call ROL USA, after this, in this conversation, had a line that Hillary Clinton was not as bad as Trump for the immediate domestic policy if she were to become president, but was worse than Trump on international foreign policy than Trump.
Right.
And certainly this dramatic order that Clinton seemed to give at the Women of the World Summit hours before Trump made what is being called the first direct attack on Syria by the U.S. forces during the six-year civil war, because that makes it not a civil war if the U.S. imperialists are directly bombing in this situation.
Right.
But the fact that Hillary Clinton had not appeared in the last 5 months since her election defeat by the Electoral College and now came out literally hours before this dramatic attack by Trump and the Trump regime on the sovereign state of Syria, you and I both see, as you said, is not at all a coincidence. And I feel pretty good about the fact, even though I'm saddened and disturbed and angry about the this latest U.S. imperialist attack on peoples of the world outside the U.S. borders, as they also do inside the U.S. borders, and Black Lives Matter, let's say, right off. Mm-hmm. But the fact that that he did this, and that she had resurfaced after 5 months in hibernation, after her election defeat,
humiliating.
And that she came and put forth in her interview hours before the attack that Trump should do this very attack on the Air Force of Syria is, as you said, and that I wholeheartedly agree, is far more than a coincidence, and it actually dramatizes the point that we had made about Clinton being an even worse force internationally than Trump. So that I think is the first point about it. And then you and I have been discussing before the show some of the various imperialist stooges who many left liberals would swear by that have come to the support of this brutal imperialist attack on Syria. They go all the way from, let's say, on the right, Fareed Zakaria, to the two leaders of the Democratic Party in the Congress, Congresswoman Pelosi and Senator Schumer from California and New York, respectively. They broke with the Democrats who at least had the human decency to criticize this act, for example, for the fact that Trump had not gone to Congress to get, this is an act of war, Trump had not gone to Congress to make any consultation. So it shows, as we've said many times, that the Republicrats, that is the Democratic and Republican Party mainstreams, have worked together and continue to be cooperative with each other in defense of the U.S. empire. And so even Noam Chomsky on Democracy Now, of all places,
both are considered ultra-leftist.
Yeah,
by both mainstream.
And Comrade Lenin, the great leader of the Great October Socialist Revolution in Russia, would have referred to the Democracy Now and Noam Chomsky as the extreme left wing of the imperialist bourgeoisie.
Yeah,
and let's not forget Brother Sanders. Unfortunately, he's more of a brother to Hillary Clinton and apparently to Donald Trump, because he's also, like Chomsky, issued a vicious statement with no documentation justifying any kind of act by Assad in this situation, and still demonized Assad at the very moment when the people of the United States have a responsibility to the rest of the peoples of the world to oppose this unilateral attack by the Trump regime directed by Hillary Clinton and against the sovereign country of Syria. So here we've got, so we're up against the Republicrats and now the kleptocrats of the Trump regime in this effort. And the other thing it makes very clear, Cindy, is our position that U.S. imperialism evidently cannot afford to leave the Middle East. So instead, every time it makes a move, it deepens the involvement. It deepens the hurt and harm being done by this criminal country, this criminal empire, against the peoples of the Middle East in order to keep control of the oil and natural gas there, and to keep the control of the oil and natural gas out of the hands of any of their partner rivals among the other imperialist powers in the world. So that's kind of how I think we see.
Well, it's interesting too, in the same talk, and I listened to the talk Clinton gave, or perhaps she was being interviewed by somebody else, and it's recorded at the Women in the World Summit. During, when she said this about, you know, taking out the airfields in Syria, she got wild applause. It reminded me of when Obama was leaving office, and he gave a speech bragging that he'd been the only president who was at war every day of his entire 8 years of his presidency. So now we have so-called liberals like Hillary Clinton, Noam Chomsky, Bernie Sanders, not only not opposing U.S. imperialism, but they didn't say anything the last full year of Obama's presidency when he dropped over 26,000 bombs on the world. Mm-hmm. You know, that's more than 60 a day, yeah. I think. Mm-hmm. So I think it's striking that the people who are lining up behind Trump now, in because he's the manager of empire
right
now, and how many liberals are afraid to oppose war and empire because they're in the Democratic Party, and they maybe intellectually or maybe even subconsciously realize that the Democrats are just as bad, if not worse, than Republicans.
I'm not sure if I think that would be a reason why they'd be afraid. I think they want the imperialist pie, many of them win without war. And when they say win, they mean win for the empire, right, over the oppressed peoples.
Right.
Maintain this empire, this vicious criminal empire, but somehow do it with less bloodshed, when behind every reactionary force in the world, U.S. imperialism stands just about at this point.
Right.
Even Assad, there's plenty of connections between Assad and the U.S. imperialism. The big problem for Obama in a few years ago, when he tried to launch an attack against Syria, was that the British people pressured the British Parliament to reject the endorsement of that policy, and it affected and infected the population of the U.S., which hadn't been brainwashed enough to back that vicious policy. And even Republican constituents were in large numbers, some of it isolationist motivated, were so resistant that Obama would have lost if he had taken it to Congress, which he fully intended to do until the last minute. Unfortunately for the world, none other than Vladimir Putin saved Obama's face and other parts of his anatomy by getting Assad to agree to give up his any poison gas or other weapons of the kind. It's never been established that the Assad regime was responsible for the attack where he supposedly went across the line that Obama wanted to then invade.
Right.
So let's look at that for a minute, because now, really almost the first decisive act of war by this empire's regime of Trump has been to carry out that very plan, and of course right hours after Hillary Clinton gave him the order to do it. I think we'd have to say that the motivation back then for Obama trying to make that war against the Assad regime was they were looking for regime change in Syria in order to be able to either have the U.S. or Israel send its air force against Iran. And Iran, the main force that was a rival to Saudi Arabia, the reactionary sheikdoms of the area, loaded with oil. And Syria under Assad was the main backer of Iran in the Middle East. And then you have Russia beyond the boundaries of the Middle East that also was giving Iran some backing. So they were looking to knock out. This is what Obama was looking to do. And obviously that's continued to be the policy. It looks like there's really another renewed drive to knock out Iran's solid backup of Assad in Syria. So that I think is a clear continuation of the policy of the empire. The fact that Sanders has taken this criminal position underscores the point that we made during the election, even when we were strongly supporting
the Sanders
campaign in the Democratic primary, that we always tried to be clear to those we were working with that Sanders was an imperialist and a scoundrel when it came to international affairs, and which is why he could easily make the agreements that he was going to support whatever Democrat won the Democratic Party primary. And he kept his word, even when it turned out, thanks to WikiLeaks, that his favorite word for the U.S. election system was, it's rigged. But I don't think he had realized that it actually was applying to the very process of the Democratic primary in which he should have emerged as the victorious candidate and then would have decisively beaten Donald Trump. So but we always were clear and tried to be clear to our readers and those with whom we have some influence that when it came to external policy, that Sanders was an imperialist and a scoundrel in defense of the empire. It was on domestic policy where his domestic program, was a wonderful step forward for working people and most of the 99% on much-needed programs that we need in the United States. Single-payer health care, paid tuition and education up through the college level in many instances, and a number of other very positive things that were part of that campaign domestically, but it never extended to any support on his part for the peoples of the world in the struggle to defeat this evil empire of U.S. imperialism.
That's how I ended it. Something I recently wrote about this situation is that the only thing that's going to dismantle the empire is international working class solidarity. It's like the people in the United States have to realize that whatever we have here, and like you said, all the forces are to support capitalism and to keep it in place, but everything we have here is at the expense of the rest of the world. So even if we supported someone like Sanders, to me it didn't show much international solidarity because we knew that he was an imperialist. So I think that's the only thing that something that's so urgently needed for the entire world is the collapse of the U.S. empire.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I might say a little bit differently than what you did is the reasons why we critically supported the Sanders campaign was precisely in order that the workers of this country and the masses of the population that are the unemployed and the underemployed, the students who are buried in debt and don't have any prospects of getting a job that's going to ever allow them to pay off those debts, is that the Sanders campaign was mobilizing these forces,
right,
the common folk of the country, and they would then be able to learn. Just like the Russian workers and the Russian peasants learned 100 years ago that the only political force in Russia that was not connected to French and British imperialism and therefore to World War I, the only way they could get out of the slaughter of World War I was by supporting and becoming part of the communist move to establish the power of the working class in Russia, and that's what did allow the Soviet, what became the Soviet Union, but the Russian peoples under the Tsar, to pull out of World War One and end their participation in World War One.
And many other far-left organizations and socialist organizations took the position also that the masses were with the campaign, and that's where we needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not with the campaign, but with the people who were supportive of the campaign.
Well, we were supportive of the campaign ourselves.
Yeah.
And for that reason I laid out.
Right.
That's how you get to be with the masses of the people who support the campaign is by supporting it as well, even if you're supporting it critically, as we did.
Right. So, do you have anything to add about this area? We got kind of off track with Sanders, but that was good because we do want to talk about the recent DNC election mm-hmm. that you had made observations about in a recent newsletter. So it was against the so-called progressive Ellison and the not-so-progressive Paris. And so who won?
Mm-hmm. Well, the people, Wall Street won.
Yeah.
Again.
Always, yeah.
Wall Street with the as far as the Democratic Party. In our view, the Democratic Party is the bigger of the two gatekeepers that make up the ruling party for finance capital in the United States, the what we call the Republicrats, because it's really a combination, a cooperation, a collaboration, a conspiracy between the mainstream Democrats and the mainstream Republicans. And that's what we've seen over the time. The fly in the ointment for them has been, over these last few years, has been the rise of the Tea Party, the anger of many, particularly white people. And the fact of the matter is that the DNC election for chair, and we have to remember back
that
WikiLeaks, right, because WikiLeaks, on the eve of the Democratic National Convention, had exposed the reality. Now, there's some dispute between whether the Trump administration or the Trump campaign was connected to Russia in some effort similar to, I guess, what they, you know, when you look in the mirror and you're U.S. imperialism, and you've been conspiring against to weigh in and to be able to name who's going to lead Russia over a last series of 20 years or so in elections, then you automatically think that Russia is trying to do it to you. So there's that aspect of it with the blatant interference of U.S. imperialism in Russian elections in this period. But the fact of the matter is, what we do know, that it is indisputable, is what WikiLeaks leaked,
mm-hmm.
and that is that the Democratic National Convention, a national committee under
Debbie
Wasserman Schultz, congresswoman from Florida, had rigged the Democratic primaries to favor Hillary Clinton and to block the Sanders campaign, whose main characteristic was it was pointing to the masses of the people that Wall Street was behind this tremendous unequal situation, unjust, unfair situation in the United States that was all working to the detriment of Wall Street and the 0.1%, and that was all to the good. That was a political education that the Sanders campaign provided. Much needed one, again, with the strong exception of dealing with the U.S. empire abroad, its criminal impact abroad.
Well, and its collaboration also with the Clinton campaign was, he always said, like you pointed out earlier, he always said he would do it, but...
And he maintained it, even though it was at the very beginning of the Democratic National Convention when this information came out, to the point that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who would have been playing a prominent role in that convention, as the head of the Democratic National Committee, had to resign, although she was then hired by
the Clinton campaign
immediately the same day. What does that tell us?
And who became acting chairman of the DNC, but Donna Brazile,
who had leaked to the Clintons the advanced questions for these debates.
And got fired by CNN for that.
Right.
But, you know, so...
So the Democratic National Committee chairs both Wasserman Schultz and Brazile thus had been exposed, as you said, as corrupt and as rigging things in favor of Clinton and to the detriment of the Sanders campaign that was critical of Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
So that was the background to the, and then people, even some of the Democrats, realized that, as we wrote at the time, Hillary Clinton was the worst candidate to put up against Trump because Trump was playing off of the anti-Wall Street rhetoric that Sanders was also raising, but Sanders was raising it in a more substantive way. In relation to the domestic policy.
Trump was more populist, taking a more, I see, like a more populist line.
Yeah, it had less substance,
right,
and even more anger, which is something that a lot of the workers, especially in this country, could relate to, because
yeah,
the most outstanding feature of the campaign was the angry voters in the primaries on both the Democratic and Republican side, who rejected the Republican candidates, the mainstream Republican and Democratic candidates, and were going for the angry candidates. And one of the two angry candidates, the one who had been most critical of Wall Street, and who had a program that would have met domestically the needs of the masses of the people of the country, was blocked by the rigged DNC. So now we're dealing with the election for a new chairperson of the DNC. As you said, the two main candidates ended up being the Congressman Keith Ellison, an Afro-American congressman from Minnesota, who was also the first Muslim congressman. So he was a black Muslim, even though he's not a member of the black Muslim
Nation of Islam.
Right. And Ellison had been the outstanding supporter of the Sanders campaign among the Afro-American people, exposed some of the lies that were told that tried to maneuver the Afro-American voters to support Clinton, even though Sanders had actually been an active force in the civil rights movement. If not a great force, he was at least active in the civil rights movement when it actually counted for something. And Ellison had played that role. He's also been one of the people that's at least had some principles in Congress, and those are few and far between.
So kind of similar to Sanders, though, you know.
Yeah, not quite as, I don't think he had been quite as corrupted.
You know, he's not so against war and stuff.
Yeah, well, yeah, you may be right, because what happened in the vote, there were a list of maneuvers that again rigged that election for Perez. But one of the things about it is that Perez was a high-ranking Latino member of the Obama administration. He had been with the Justice Department, then he was Secretary of Labor, both under Obama. So he was a high-ranking Latino running against a high-ranking Afro-American. Then there was a surprise candidate who was the mayor of the city in Indiana that Notre Dame is in. South Bend, Indiana. And I'm a football fan. South Bend, Indiana, and he was a gay man, who was from the Midwest.
She's talking about identity politics.
Exactly, and he was going against an Afro-American congressman from the Midwest. So you know the imperialists have learned how to play identity politics pretty well. And the mayor of South Bend, who was endorsed, by the way, by the Economist, the British Imperialist magazine, actually openly endorsed against our Congressman Ellison, ended up dropping out at the very moment where he would have been dropping in to be considered among the candidates for the vote. Then there was something that came up about that the Democratic National Committee found that the hotel where they were having all of this go on, which you know those hotels are not like Sleep Inn or Days Inn, but somehow that hotel didn't have the internet capacity to meet a regulation of the Democratic National Committee that would have allowed the candidates in the second ballot to be able to know which delegates had voted for which people in the first go-around. And so that you could then approach, if you were a candidate like Ellison, you could then approach those delegates to solicit their vote in the second go-around. So that was one of the things that they, and this is again under Donna Brazil, still as the interim chair, who had replaced the openly discredited
Wasserman Schultz.
So it was really, it was a lot of hanky-panky, of the political maneuvering and cheating type that the Democrats are now becoming consistent with, it seems, with these Democratic National Committee chairs. So Tom Perez won that vote. And sadly, Ellison, who could have now led a... When it was clear the Democratic Party didn't want to win the election as much as they wanted to defend Wall Street.
Right.
That Ellison... They weren't going to turn over a new leaf. Perez had been put in by Obama and Biden and representing Wall Street to block Ellison from becoming the chair. So even those that had the illusion, well, maybe the Democrats will learn from this and not put up a Wall Street candidate against a Trump-like candidate that's playing on the people's hostility to Wall Street and rig it that way so that the anti-Wall Street Democratic candidate could at least have some kind of fighting chance to win that vote. So I think that really says to your listeners, and to anyone that you and I can reach, that the Democratic Party just represents Wall Street. That's it.
Uh-huh.
And if you want Wall Street to continue to win and Main Street to continue to lose, then vote for the Democratic Party, because they're it. And those white workers, largely, you know, 37% of union households, at least, voted for Trump. That was a smarter move. It meant they were paying better attention,
right?
Because they were justifiably angry at being screwed by the Wall Street Republicrats,
Democratic. In those rust belts where.
Mm-hmm. Where workers had been most harmed by globalism
and
capital.
Clinton actually thought she had it made, in some of those states. But, it just shows how out of touch the Democratic Party is with the workers,
right. And it is interesting that Ellison, similar to what Sanders did, even after it was exposed that he had been screwed out of the Democratic Party nomination, he still kept his part of whatever that bargain actually was and supported that vicious war criminal,
right.
Hillary Clinton,
right.
for president.
Mm-hmm.
And likewise, Ellison ended up accepting a phony position as a newly created position as the assistant to the Democratic National Chair, the vice chair, I think it's called. He accepted that position knowing what had just happened to him. So it was a very similar thing that had been done to maybe his mentor or his colleague, Senator Sanders. And these people, they end up being gatekeepers.
Uh-huh.
for Wall Street and U.S. imperialism.
And I don't understand what... I don't see anything that Sanders gained from...
Well, that's his problem. I'm more concerned about what the masses gained or lost.
Right.
And they lost in this whole thing.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
he may have got to keep his life. In other words, we don't know if he was threatened.
Yeah.
There's a lot at stake in the workers not learning the lessons from the politics of this country, the rotten, corrupt politics that are totally connected to the rotten, corrupt economics of the country.
But
behind that is the fact that we now have the grossest inequality between the top 0.1% and even the top 1%, and the other 99% of us, or the other 99.9% of us, that there's ever been in the history of the United States. So how can we be thinking that there's a party that's got a interest in supporting the workers under these conditions? We need one.
Yeah, well, I was going to say that brings us back to Trump, because you said maybe Sanders, we don't know. Sanders, like, you know, you're playing hardball when you play up in that league with the Clintons and, you know, the other people like that. But, you know, Trump, no matter what we think about him and, you know, don't support him, I always think that, you know, on January 21st, after every inauguration, impeachment proceedings should be instituted against the president. Yeah. You know, they're just, and this is all just, you know, imperialist, capitalist machinations, like the ruling class.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Trump did go in speaking ill of the CIA. He did go in, you know, saying that the U.S. policies in the Middle East, they weren't getting us anywhere, you know. It wasn't like he didn't care about the people of Iraq or Syria or whatever.
It wasn't like he cared about them. He didn't.
No.
Yeah,
didn't care about them. He cared about that it was, he thought it was harming, you know, the United States or whatever.
Or his interests.
His interests and the interest of, you know, his class.
Mm-hmm.
But it took him a while, I think, to fall in line because 16 so-called intelligence agencies came out saying that Russia interfered in the U.S. elections. Somebody was able to jump over the White House fence and walk around for like 2 hours before the Secret Service noticed that they were there. I think that these were clear messages to Trump that you better fall in line with the imperial plan.
It could be. But I still believe that Trump is, you know, the U.S. imperialists have been in the saddle almost for the whole period since the end of World War II in 1945.
Right, you know, if not before.
About 70 years. About 70 years. And probably at least the last quarter of a century, it's functioned as an empire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it had hegemony for all that period of 70 years, but for the last 25, 30 years, it's been functioning as an empire. And so it's an unjust situation that you may be right but I think that Trump is a kleptocrat of the kind that U.S. imperialism has been supporting in Latin America and Asia and so forth. It's kind of a blowback effect, just like I think George W. Bush was a similar force, that these people don't have to know anything. They have to be big enough and bullying enough to bully their way in these countries controlled by the U.S., and that now seems to include the U.S. itself.
Right.
So I think Trump is more concerned about the Trump family empire,
absolutely,
the Trump business empire, by far than he is about the U.S. empire. And that's a problem for those whose job it is to defend the U.S. empire.
Right.
And I don't think he's totally
those forces,
I don't think he's totally been won over, even at this point. So I think there is that distinction. Cindy, I know I would like to, if it's okay with you, get in a warning to your listeners and our friends out there. Because in 1933, and Trump has definitely features that remind one of Adolf Hitler. His combination of populism, I think you mentioned earlier, his nationalism and his chauvinism, his toward people of from whether it's religions like Muslim people, or whether it's people of color, if it's Latino immigrants, Afro-Americans, and so on. He has that combination that was so lethal in Adolf Hitler and his regime back in the 1930s, and only was stopped by the heroic struggle, really, of the Soviet people in World War II, with a little help from the United States and other forces, democratic and anti-imperialist and anti-fascist forces around the world. So I did want to remind your viewers, or to share with them, that when Hitler was appointed the Chancellor of Germany by the president, according to the most authoritative bourgeois expert on the question of the rise and fall of the Third Reich, and that was the name of his book that was a bestseller in the 1960s, William Shirer, a bourgeois journalist of the time, did this in-depth analysis, and I'm going to read, if it's okay with you, a little bit from his discussion of how the Reichstag fire actually happened.
Okay.
And who exposed it. Is that okay?
Yep.
So, according to Shirer, in talking about the Nazification of Germany, he said that the president, backed by the army and the conservatives, had made Hitler chancellor. But that his political power, though great, was not complete. It was shared with these three sources of authority, the president, the army, and the conservatives, which had put him into office and which were outside and, to some extent, distrustful of the National Socialist Movement. Well, we know Trump went in even not only against almost every newspaper in the United States who editorialized in favor of Clinton, but also against almost every Republican bigwig of the old Republican moderate Wall Street type. So that's a big problem, and it's a big problem for Trump, and it's a big problem for the other side of it as well. Hitler's immediate task, therefore, was to quickly eliminate them, those three forces that put him in, to eliminate them from the driver's seat, make his party the exclusive master of the state, and then, with the power of an authoritarian government and its police, you notice how supportive Trump is of the police against black lives that matter. Okay. Carry out the Nazi revolution. This is what Shirer called it. And 5 hours after he was sworn in at 5 p.m. on January 30, 1933, Hitler held his first cabinet meeting, and they, of course, in the Nuremberg trials and all, the minutes of these things were able to become accessible to the world public at the Nuremberg trial. And it showed how quickly and adroitly Hitler, aided by the crafty Goering, began to take his conservative colleagues for a ride. That's an expression. I think it's still used now. Hindenburg had named Hitler to head not a presidential cabinet, but one based on a majority in the Reichstag, which was the parliament. However, the Nazis and the Nationalists, the only two parties represented in the government, had only 247 seats out of 583 in parliament, and thus lacked a majority. And the centrist party, which had the center party, which had 70 seats, was looking for some concessions. So they wanted to find a way, the Nazis did, to do this around and without having to make any concessions to the center party at all. So it was proposed that to simply suppress the Communist Party, and with its 100 seats eliminated, the Nazis and the Nationalists would have a majority. Shira goes on in that vein. And Goering's key position as Minister of the Interior of Prussia now began to be noticed. Goering removed hundreds of Republican officials and replaced them with Nazis, mostly SA and SS officers. And he ordered the police to avoid having any rivalry with the SA and the SS. But on the other hand, to show no mercy to those who were hostile to the state. He urged the police to make use of firearms and warned that those who didn't would be punished.
Wow.
Okay. It was an outright call for the shooting down of all who opposed Hitler by the police of a state, Prussia, which controlled two-thirds of Germany. Okay. And Goering then on February 22nd established an auxiliary police force of 50,000 men, of whom 40,000 were drawn from the ranks of the SA and the SS, and police power in Prussia was thus largely carried out by Nazi thugs. It was a rash German who appealed to such a police for protection against the Nazi terrorists. Okay, so this set the stage for the Reichstag fire. On the evening of February 27th, the Reichstag was set on fire.
And what is
the Reichstag? The Reichstag was where the parliament met. And this was what Hitler was supposed to be, as the previous thing I had read, that Hitler was named by Hindenburg as the head, not of a presidential cabinet, but one based on a majority in the Reichstag. So now the Nazis, in order to get complete domination, they have to have complete control. And the Reichstag, once the fire happened, the emergency decrees that went out, and the fire happened on February 27th, so a little less than a month after Hitler went in as chancellor. The thing that surprised me when I went over this this so-called masterwork by this bourgeois expert on the rise and fall of the Third Reich was how clear he was that the Nazis themselves had done this fire. And he says, even at Nuremberg, the mystery could not be entirely unraveled, though there is enough evidence to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that it was the Nazis who planned the arson and carried it out for their own political ends. And he talks about Goering's projection, and that Goering himself boasted that he had done it to General Franz Halder, chief of the German General Staff. And he said, according to Franz Halder, the general, the only one who really knows about the Reichstag is I, because I set it on fire. And with that, he slapped his thigh with the flat of his hand. A person who had a slow mind named Van der Lubbe had been made a dupe and was encouraged to try to set the Reichstag on fire. But the main job was to be done without his knowledge by the stormtroopers. Indeed, it was established at the subsequent trial at Leipzig that the Dutch half-wit, which was a term that was used when this book came out, did not possess the means to set so vast a building on fire so quickly. 2.5 minutes after he entered, the great central hall was fiercely burning. He had only his shirt for tinder. The main fires, according to the testimony of experts at the trial, had been set with considerable quantities of chemicals and gasoline. It was obvious that one man could not have carried them into the building, nor would it have been possible for him to start so many fires in so many scattered places in so short a time. Van der Lubbe, this Dutch person, was arrested on the spot, and Goering, as he afterward told the court, wanted to hang him at once. The next day, Ernst Torgler...
Patsy.
Yeah, exactly. Patsy. The next day, Ernst Torgler, parliamentary leader of the communists, remember they had 100 representatives in the Reichstag, gave himself up to the police when he heard that Goering had implicated him. And a few days later, Georgi Dimitrov, a Bulgarian communist who later became prime minister of Bulgaria, and two other Bulgarian communists were apprehended by the police. Their subsequent trial before the Supreme Court at Leipzig turned into something of a fiasco for the Nazis, and especially for Goering, whom Dimitrov, acting as his own lawyer, easily provoked into making a fool of himself in a series of stinging cross-examinations. At one point, according to the court record, Goering screamed at the Bulgarian, "Out with you, you scoundrel!" And the judge said to the police officer, "Take him away." And Dimitrov, in a Nazi court, said, as he was being led away by the police, "Are you afraid of my questions here, Minister President?" And Goering said, "You wait until we get you outside this court, you scoundrel." Okay. Torgler and the three Bulgarians were acquitted. That includes Dimitrov. Uh-huh. Though the German communist leader was immediately taken into so-called protective custody, where he remained until his death during the Second World War. And of course we know that Dimitrov went on to become the head of the Communist International and was the main leader of the communist strategy that won World War II, called the United Front against Fascism. And then he, as Shira pointed out, after the war he became the leader of the country of Bulgaria. So what heroism of the German communist,
right?
And I mean, excuse me, of the Bulgarian communist in the Nazi German court against one of the main leaders of fascism in Germany, Hermann Goering, directly against them. But it also was an indication, the fact that the Nazis were able to go so far, that not many forces stood up to the Nazis as decisively as the communists did, both there and in World War II itself, where they defeated the German fascists in battle and drove them all the way back to Berlin. But the interesting thing is that even though under Dimitrov's brilliant defense, and where they ended up getting Dimitrov and the other Bulgarians out of the country quickly, they didn't want them there.
Uh-huh.
They couldn't handle them.
Right.
That despite the trial, despite the subserviency of the court to the Nazi authorities, cast a great deal of suspicion on Goering and the Nazis. But it came too late to have any practical effect, for Hitler had lost no time in exploiting the Reichstag fire to the limit. So this is where the comrades of the Revolutionary Organization of Labor, USA, want to warn the citizens and the people of the United States. On the day following the fire, February 28, Hitler prevailed on President Hindenburg to sign a decree, quote, "for the protection of the people and the state," unquote, suspending the 7 sections of the Constitution which guaranteed individual and civil liberties, and describing it as a defensive, this is a quote, "a defensive measure against communist acts of violence endangering the state." So this is, surrendering the liberties of the people to the Nazis. And it ended up being the vehicle through which the Nazi regime was able to take total control. The Reichstag was at least temporarily, suspended from being able to act.
Right.
And as Shira says, this was the first experience Germans had with Nazi terror backed up by the government. And with all the resources of the national and Prussian governments, remember the Prussia was two-thirds of, of Germany, at their disposal, and with plenty of money from big business in their coffers. This is a bourgeois journalist. The Nazis carried on an election propaganda such as Germany had never seen before. For the first time, the state-run radio carried the voices of Hitler, Goering, and Goebbels to every corner of the land. The streets bedecked with swastika flags echoed to the tramp of the stormtroopers. There were mass rallies, torchlight parades, the din of loudspeakers, and so forth. By the way, the publication of the, this is again Shira, the publication of the quote documents proving the communist conspiracy, unquote, were promised but never made. They were never published. The fact, however, that the Prussian government itself vouched for their authenticity impressed many Germans. Perhaps they were also impressed, says Shira, by Goering's threats. And Goering is quoted here as saying, "Fellow Germans, my measures will not be crippled by any judicial thinking. I don't have to worry about justice. My mission is only to destroy and exterminate. Nothing more.
Yeah.
Certainly I shall use the power of the state and the police to the utmost, my dear communists, so don't draw any false conclusions. But the struggle to the death in which my fist will grasp your necks, I shall lead with those down there, the brown shirts." So, and then Shira says, on March 5, 1933, the day of the last democratic elections they were to know during Hitler's life, they spoke with their ballots. Despite all the terror and intimidation, the majority of them rejected Hitler. The Nazis led the polling with 17.25 million votes, an increase of some 5.5 million, but it comprised only 44% of the total vote. A clear majority still eluded Hitler. All the persecution and suppression of the previous weeks did not prevent the Center Party from actually increasing its vote to a little, from about 4.25 to almost 4.5 million. With its ally, the Catholic Bavarian People's Party, it obtained a total of 5.5 million. Even the Social Democrats held their position as the second largest party, polling over 7 million votes. A small drop in there. The Communists lost 1 million supporters, but still polled almost 5 million votes in the face of this terror that was going on. So this is how the Nazis ended up getting total authority in Germany. And the warning is that either it could go one way or another, but the idea of either the Wall Street folks worrying about Trump, the Trump family empire, trumping for Trump as president, Trump's concern about the U.S. empire, could lead them to dismiss Trump in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
They, after all, put Pence in there to be the vice president for good reason, and so that could be one way that could happen. Or some other form of an emergency. Trump has carried out all this stuff without any direct, drastic emergency yet, and he's still been decisive, and he's been decisively rebuked, such as with the Muslim ban on travel in the United States, which has been rejected by the courts. So the idea that either because of the threats of Wall Street losing their maximum profits, which is all they're concerned about, or something involving a disruption that Trump may help create by his ignorance and chauvinism and his bullying violent ways, that he could be dismissed by them, or he could use a Reichstag fire type of situation to get rid of these annoying things like any press that's not his press, and any political representatives that are not connected to his interests. And that's the warning I wanted to give, because we're living in a country that has been at perpetual war with the oppressed peoples around the world for decades now.
Right.
and we have, in this country, a military-industrial complex that President Eisenhower warned about that has gotten so out of hand with billions of dollars and so on, that this all could come to a situation where the U.S. will not give up its empire without destroying the world for human habitation.
Well, I think in a smaller way, I kind of see this happening last week when the so-called sarin gas attack by allegedly by Assad
yeah, right.
was used for Trump to, you know, send 59 Tomahawk cruise missiles into that airfield, that we see a lot of the people who previously opposed Trump falling in line with him now and praising Trump.
Mm-hmm.
So we see that in him consolidating his power a little bit by that very...
Exactly.
And it was very, you know, compared to U.S., compared to Obama, compared to what the U.S. has done, it was a comparatively small act that really sent, you know, I'm just going to use this term, neocons and pundits like Brian Williams and Fareed Zakaria and Elliot Abrams into orgasmic proclamations of how beautiful it was and how now he's acting presidential and blah, blah, blah. And not just neoconservative, but also neoliberal pundits were all, and you know, we saw Noam Chomsky and Sanders parrot the line of the evil Assad in Russia and things like that.
Right.
So, you know, in a small way, in a bigger way, they used 9/11 to take away a lot of our civil liberties and bomb the frickin' world to pieces, you know, especially Iraq and Afghanistan.
Right. And at the very least, the Bush regime or the intelligence services serving the Bush regime knew about the attack.
Right.
You know, it allowed it to happen.
Clearly.
Yeah, at least allowed it to happen.
Yeah.
And it served the neocon strategy because it became a cover for them.
The project
invading
the American century.
Right. And they had wanted to go into Iraq, and they used it, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. At all.
Or Afghanistan. You
right.
know, yeah. it just...
So...
And we're still in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Absolutely.
And
the U.S.
almost,
is still in Iraq and
I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I don't know why
That's
I'm
all right.
saying
no, no,
that. Why I keep saying
right.
that. The U.S. is still in Iraq and Afghanistan militarily and otherwise occupying those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And how long has it been? It's almost 16 years. Afghanistan is the longest war the U.S. has ever been involved in, and the destruction in those countries is heartbreaking.
I know we're kind of winding down.
Yeah, we should.
So I wanted to.
But I was going to ask. I want to say that we're hopefully going to be together again soon, and I really want to talk about the 100th anniversary of the Great October Socialist Revolution, Bolshevik, in Russia, and the significance of it today, the important gains that it had been made. But I want to remind our listeners that ROL USA newsletter is publishing a series of articles about it, and it's posted also at Cindy Sheehan's soapbox and at raillightblog.com. And me, being a creature of the internet, know that these articles are filling a niche. A void. They're filling a void about this. So I just want you to briefly talk about why today.
I mean, I'm a revolutionary,
right.
And
yes,
I think that nothing's going to change here without a revolution. Mm-hmm. So tell us why this is important us here today.
Okay. If you'll indulge me, I'll talk briefly about that, but end on that.
Mm-hmm.
But first, I do want to point out that it's also no accident, in my opinion, that Trump took that action in Syria at the very moment that he was about to meet with the leader of the Chinese government, which was also sending a message to the Chinese that they better watch out and do what U.S. imperialism tells them
to do. And subsequently has sent another carrier group to the Korean Peninsula.
Mm-hmm. So, right. So, and that may well have to do with trying to scare the Chinese leadership into supporting the U.S. and Korea.
Right.
Yeah. So that, but I did want to make sure that we got that point in.
And that we still have not had a treaty or an end to the U.N. conflict, U.S. U.N. conflict between North and South Korea. Parenthetically, we can say that.
But to get to the question, so we can end on a positive note of some hope. At least.
Well, inspiration.
And that is this. The connection is, as I said earlier in the program, it was only with the Bolshevik Revolution, when the workers took power in greater Russia, that the Bolshevik-led working class and peasant masses, who were the soldiers and sailors of Russia, who were getting slaughtered in the war as the cannon fodder for British and French imperialism and on their side of the struggle, pulled out of the war. It was all because all the other political forces in Russia were connected to imperialism, and only the Bolsheviks under Lenin were independent of those forces and opposed to those forces. And so, really, the question of peace was the driving question at that moment, even though land and bread were the other two main slogans of the Bolsheviks and the masses in the Russian Revolution. Peace was the cutting-edge issue. Peace was the revolutionary question, and peace is exactly what the Bolshevik Party delivered, as well as land and bread. The bread took a little longer to deliver. Land to the peasants was an immediate move. About 400 million acres immediately went to the peasants. But peace, and that's the reason. That's what connects us and you, the beautiful anti-war, anti-imperialist war especially, fighter that you are. That's what connects you to this 100th anniversary celebration of the Russian Revolution. And I look forward to us getting together again and discussing some of the great fruits that the working class in particular in Russia and the oppressed nationalities, because Russia had been the prison house of nations, that was what it was called, under the Tsar, and under the Bolsheviks it became the emancipated nations that were in a voluntary union called the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and proved that it was voluntary when during World War II, unlike France, unlike the Netherlands, unlike Belgium, unlike just about any, well, unlike any country other than the USSR, they fought for their country against the most brutal military machine in modern human history, and they defeated that monstrous machine.
And made tremendous sacrifice.
To do it.
Yeah. And that is inspirational. Led the, like you said earlier, the fight against fascism, which we may be involved in right now.
Right
here.
Yes, it's very good. Very good to be with you.
Okay. So, and like I said, we need to really go into detail about the anniversary of that. And so, next time we're together, hopefully, we can make that happen. So, Ray Light, thank you so much for taking time to be on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox again.
It's always a privilege to be with you, Sister Sheehan.
Well, it's always fascinating to listen to your knowledge and your wisdom. So thank you so much. For this week, I hope you check out the archives from The People Speak with Cindy Sheehan. I have been posting and doing a live show on BBS Radio every Tuesday night at 6 p.m. Pacific time, but I also post the archives at Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. Excuse me. Also go to Rayo Light blog and check out the Rayo Light newsletter from the Revolutionary Organization of Labor USA. I'd like to thank Don DeBar for engineering this show. I'd like to thank Ray Light for taking a lot of his time to be our guest this week. And I'd like to thank you for listening and supporting the show. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You've been listening to The Soapbox. Peace out for now.